dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we continue with the second part of our series on water privatization with material from a major conference that took place last month in Rhinebeck, New York. Our speakers tonight will be Indian environmentalist Vandana Shiva and John Todd from the United States, who describes himself as a water doctor and has worked at developing innovative systems for sustainable water purification.
Never a hard-working man I oppress, so take your pace.
Vandana Shiva is internationally known for her work in support of preserving cultural and biodiversity and as an opponent of corporate globalization. She spoke on September 6th at the Water of Life conference.
Today I want to share with you my involvement engagement with water. I happened to have chosen to do physics as my lifetime's vocation, but it got kind of interrupted. And there was a tiny interruption in 74, before I was leaving for my doctoral work. I went to visit my favorite spots in the Himalaya. I come from the Himalaya. And found the stream I had swam in all my childhood had disappeared. It had died. I then got involved with the local movement to stop the logging, because that particular stream had died because the World Bank had financed the cutting of our oak forests to plant apple orchards, and apple orchards never worked. We got little, horrible little apples that size that never sold. But anyway, the oak forest died, and with it, the streams. And I got then involved with, as a volunteer for the CHIPCO movement, which I call my university in ecology. I did my PhD in University of Western Ontario in physics, but I did my super PhD with the women of CHIPCO, who gave amazing lessons to our country, including people like me. One very simple lesson, the slogan that became our environmental slogan. And these movements were pre-Stockholm. And Stockholm was supposed to be about teaching the world about environmental protection. But pre-Stockholm, 300 years ago, about 300 people had died in Rajasthan protecting the Khejri tree, which is a sacred tree, and was going to be cut so that the limestone could be fired to whitewash the palace. And the women said, but this is our security from desertification. Rajasthan is a desert. The Khejri is a tree that conserves moisture under those conditions, and therefore it's a sacred tree. In the 70s, the second CHIPCO, and CHIPCO means hug, hugging. It basically means to hug. And the women were coming out in hundreds of thousands to say, you can't cut these trees till you cut us, because the trees are our source of water. And I remember in those days, the smirk in the scientific community saying, huh, trees and water, how do they go together? And there was a lovely slogan the women had. I remember the two slogans that stayed. One was a slogan they created during the day. They came with lanterns. And the logging site had police to stop the women. They had all the forest officers. My father himself was a forest conservator and was very supportive of the movement. The women came out with lanterns, and the senior forest officer says, you women don't realize it's day. Why are you carrying lanterns during the day? It's supposed to be for the night. Saying, we're carrying them to tell you that you are in the darkness of thinking, that trees are about revenue and timber and raisin. Raisin because the pine used to be tapped for the raisin that goes into all cosmetics and everything. And they said, forests are really about, they are the source of our water, our soil. And in those days, they said, pure air. 10 years later, people said, we accept the soil and water, but the pure air, well, climate change. remember yesterday Winona's talk about the guardians of the different forms of water. The other slogan I remember very clearly was, we'd have meeting after meeting and the officials would come and say, we're doing this for development and you are interfering in development policy. And the women in the local dialect would always say, any policy that can't think of water is a blind policy. It sounds much nicer in Garhwali. But yeah, that a policy, ghas la kru bina yojana kani. And well, the persistence paid off, about a decade of constant action. And I started to do reports. That's how I started to become ecology expert. I started to study everything under the sun, on forests, on hydrology. And 1981, we got a logging ban in the High Himalaya. But that threw me into the next water battle. I was still doing university teaching, but the ministry called on us to do an impact of mining in Doon Valley. Doon Valley happens to be my home, so of course I jumped on the opportunity. I'd also just had my little boy, and I'd lost my mother, so I thought, perfect, I work in my home base, bring up my child. And as a result of that study, I learned, I mean, the wonderful thing about being a server of nature is you never stop studying. You never stop learning. There's always new stuff you learn. So we were told to look at mining and the terms of reference, you know, in official contracts, you always have a TOR. Well, the TOR said to find ways to stop the ugliness of the scars that the mines were leaving. It was all an issue of how bad the mountains looked. But very rapidly, with a little field work, little discussion with women, it turned out quite clearly the issue was water again. Because what was being mined was limestone. And limestone, when it's cracked, dissolves over time with the rainfall, leaving amazing caves inside what is called the karst landscape. That's where the water gets stored. And on our calculation, the function that that limestone belt in the mountains was performing was 20 billion rupees worth of cement construction. But as the limestone was being taken out to make your sugar a little more white, to make steel, to produce steel, pulp and paper industry, just every industry uses limestone. And this was super fine limestone because it had some point been, you know, under the Tethys Sea and had now risen. We did the study, we did a public interest litigation. Eventually, we also had to back it up with direct action when all the mines didn't close. But I want to share with you the judgment that closed those mines. The judgment recognized that water is more important than commerce. And the courts ruled that this is the first case of its kind in the country involving issues related to environmental and ecological balance. This is 1980s language, so I love it. The questions arising for considerations are of grave moment and of significance not only to the people residing in the Missouri hills that form the part of the Himalaya, but also for the welfare of the generality of the people living in the country. It brings into sharp focus the conflict between development and conservation and the need to reconcile the two. And it went on to order the closure of the mine, saying the price that is being paid, a price has to be paid for protecting and safeguarding the right of the people. And for this reason, the loss of revenues of the miners is a legitimate public price that needs to be paid. Of course, they're talking about cattle and homes because villages were getting drowned. I have witnessed in my valley streams that used to be 20 feet deep becoming beds of rubble and mine waste 10 feet above the land, with the water courses then just finding their way, washing off villages. The last stream ran dry in the summertime. I mean, I love being in Omega because it's reminding me of childhood. When we used to walk in our valley, we'd walk like this, you know, skipping streams every second foot. There used to be a stream coming out, like this place, just bursting with streams. But with a combination of logging and mining and all other activities that go under the name of development, water-abundant regions have been turned water-scarce. I believe nature does not create water scarcity anyway. Even the desert has the right amount of water for the desert. It's different from the water of the rainforest, but it's right for the desert. The desert species needs that much. Desert cultures have evolved to live with that much. Rajasthan has among the most sophisticated water systems of the world. And they still support the communities of Rajasthan. UNICEF has paid huge amounts, but the UNICEF projects have come and gone, supplied water for 1 or 2 years, finished. There's a wonderful Gandhian friend, a mutual friend, Anupam Mishra, and he's documented the Rajasthan water systems and the culture. We've done a translation of one of his books because he writes in Hindi, and it's called The Radiant Raindrops of Rajasthan, and he basically says that every drop of rain in Rajasthan is converted by human love into never leaving a scarcity for life in the desert. It's the most populated desert in the world. Not because it was accepted that that was the amount of rain you'd get, that's the water you had, and you lived right with it. With the other ways, we've become so smart in finding ways to create scarcity of water where it shouldn't be. Coastal zones are the water-richest areas because that's where all the water of all landmass drains into the sea. But starting with the 90s, again with World Bank lending, the entire coastal area, 7,000 kilometers of coastline in India, as the coastline in Ecuador, as the coastline in Philippines, as the coastline in Bangladesh and in Thailand, you can just run through every country in the world, was turned into industrial shrimp farms. Not that shrimps don't grow in the northern countries, they do. It's just that the industry is so polluting that they shipped it off to the south. The consumers are all in the north. Women started to break these ponds. Then they started to get arrested. So they write to me and say, we need your help. So I went down, did the studies, filed a litigation on their behalf. And we got a Supreme Court order to close the industrial shrimp farms. Why was it necessary? Because shrimp belong to the sea and seawater belongs to the sea. But for shrimp farming, you've got to pump seawater onto the land. Then you have got to stock these ponds, which shrimp fish don't like to spawn in captivity. So you capture pregnant shrimp in the sea. Then you have to tear their eyes out to force them to lay. And their PhD is done on how to force shrimp to spawn under captivity. And then you stock these ponds under population densities that they're not supposed to be in. So you've got to pump chemicals to keep them going. Only 15% of the protein fed to the shrimp goes to make the shrimp protein. The rest is waste, which is then pumped out to kill the rest of the fish in the mangroves and in the estuaries. 15 times more fresh fish is caught to feed industrial fish farms. And this, according to, again, going back to the World Bank documents, we had to do this because marine resources were running short, so we had to find more efficient way to grow fish to be able to supplement what the sea provides. And the way we supplement what the sea provides is fish 15 times more to produce less fish and turn the rest into pollution. The figures are $1 of trade in shrimp, profits in shrimp, leave behind them $10 of destruction in the local economy and ecology. For every job generated in industrial shrimp farming, 15 jobs are destroyed in farming and fisheries locally. You just have to travel to these areas to see even coconut trees die, because as the salt water from these ponds starts to leach, paddy can't grow, coconuts can't grow. And when the parents have been left with no livelihoods in fisheries and agriculture, they then catch the little kids to make them stand in the mangroves and bring up and catch the tiny fingerlings to stock the ponds. 14 hours a day, little kids standing in the water, catching little eggs and fingerlings. And that's the root. You know, if you really want to find out the roots of child labor, the place to look is the destruction of the jobs and livelihoods of parents, not create conditionalities through consumerism. The place to solve the child labor problem is to defend the livelihoods of the parent. There is no parent, no matter how poor in the world, who would say to their child, you work, I'll sit at home. There's another brilliant way in which we created waste in water. And it is what was sold as the agriculture revolution, the green revolution. It even got a Nobel Prize. But if you look to the green revolution from the perspective of water, and that's the perspective with which I entered, because there were river conflicts, there were assassinations, We had war. 30,000 people died in Punjab during a terrorism that has been forgotten. The terrorism of the 80s in Punjab that took the life of Indira Gandhi was behind the crash of the Kanishka plane that flew from Canada and was bombed above Ireland. Well, the Green Revolution takes 10 times more water to produce the same amount of food. But we were always told it produces more food. And the limiting factor in agriculture is not land, it's water. You can have all the land in the world. You don't have water, you won't get the plants. You won't get a crop. Not only did it increase the use per crop, for example, you can have rice varieties that grow under what we call rain-fed conditions. They don't need irrigation. You can have irrigated varieties that need less water. But under the Green Revolution, because it was really a revolution to absorb more chemicals into farming, you needed more water to dissolve those chemicals. And the Green Revolution was in two or three crops. So it was about rice and wheat and corn, which meant a disappearance of the amazing agricultural diversity that has been our partner in conservation. Millets, the ragi, the mandwa, the jangora, the sorghum, the pearl millet, staples of the large majority of the people who don't live in wet areas. It uses only 300 millimeters of water. Industrial paddy farming uses 2,500 millimeters of water. And the millets have 20 to 30 times more nutritional possibilities. You look at the calcium, you look at the iron. So we're literally growing 20 times less nutrition, using 10 times more water, and saying we have produced more food. In my view, industrial agriculture is the single most important reason for water scarcity in the world. Winona referred to this for the West. But across the third world, you've heard of arsenic poisoning, arsenic contamination in Bangladesh and Bengal. It's all related to Green Revolution technologies, getting greedy to get deeper and deeper, and the deeper you go, then you start tapping layers of stored arsenic in the subsoil. One of our commitments in the organization I founded for SEEDS, Navdanya, is really to bring back water conservation through your agriculture and through your crops. That what you grow determines how much water you will have. And in a way, we are literally creating deserts under the illusion of the pseudo-efficiency of industrial agriculture. Not only were these maldevelopment paradigms responsible for creating scarcity, literally in the 80s and 90s, till the 80s in India, you could go to any river, any lake, any pond and drink water. Drink the water. Just 20 years ago. But in 10 years, water was assumed to be merely a sink for waste. That was its main value. And every story we've heard from the first day from Robert Kennedy's presentation is about treating water bodies as deposits for our way of industrial waste. And one would think, having recognized that there's a crisis, we'd say, let's change our practices. Let's change the way we produce goods, use less toxics, don't use PCBs, don't use pesticides. No, what basically happened was, again, the World Bank and the IMF and corporations started to see an opportunity in the scarcity that had been created. And let me quote from you, Monsanto. Monsanto tried to get into water, but wasn't very successful. But this is what they wrote in their strategic document when they were planning to enter water. First, we believe that discontinuities, and for them discontinuities is either major policy changes, which means privatization as a policy, or breaks in resource quality and quantity, means scarcity and pollution, are likely, particularly in the area of water, and we will be well positioned via these businesses to profit even more significantly when these discontinuities occur. And then the document went on to say, because the scarcities leave permanent need. People can't live without water. These are sustainable profits, and this is sustainability. And this was under their sustainable development wing. You know, profits out of water was sustainable development. It's, that it was not sustainable development is very clear from the fact that Monsanto could never get it. But they went on to say, and the third wonderful thing about it is that we'll never have to spend money because the World Bank, the USAID, and other agencies will underwrite all this investment for us. Now, this is not the story that you're told when water privatization and corporate takeover of water is promoted. The story you're told at the World Water Forum in Kyoto every 2-3 years when the big agencies meet is municipalities have become too poor, public systems are too poor, more investment is needed. That investment can only come from the global private sector, and therefore global corporations must be allowed to enter the water supply system. The projections of what they'll make out of this are huge. Just for Europe, currently it's 280 billion assessment, and European Commission is assessing by 2010, 640 billion. And current assessments for water, world water mass markets now is a trillion. But to tell you how it actually works, let me tell you the story of something I've had to get involved in, because it is about the rivers that have shaped me, the Ganga, the Yamuna. Last year, July, there's an ad in the paper which says new water plant being set up by Degremont, and the water will be brought from Tehri. Now, both those things, of course, woke me up. Degremont, because I knew it was a subsidiary of Suez, the world's biggest company. Tony laid it all out, even without his pictures. But Tehri also, because Tehri is two valleys behind mine. And it is the confluence of two tributaries of the Ganges, the Bhagirathi and the Bilangana. And between those confluences is the ancient capital of my region called Tehri. Starting the 70s, a dam started to get built there. And we've had protests and protests and protests. I have witnessed 3 generations of people provide leadership to that protest and go, you know. There used to be the Saklanis who were in their 60s then, and they've died. Mrs. Saklani used to walk daily and light a lamp on the banks of the Ganges and say, they cannot tame this river. Bhagirathi, the story of the descent of the Ganga is it can't be tamed. You know, they had to invoke Shiva to contain the force of her fall on earth. You just have to read the beautiful story of the descent of the Ganga. She says, they'll never be able to build this dam. And every day she would go. Every evening she would go. Even today, there are about 100 women sitting in Old Tehri town. The town has been destroyed. Contractors were paid to break the homes of people in front of their eyes. But these women haven't left. They're living under tarpaulin. They're living under shed. Saying, we're not going to leave our homes. 100,000 people displaced by this dam, which is then supposed to bring the water to Delhi, 350 miles away. Delhi is on the banks of a river, Yamuna, which has been polluted and destroyed. Now, when the big corporations come, they talk about cleaning up our rivers. But they're not cleaning up the Yamuna, next to which they're building the plant. They're taking clean water from the Himalaya, Ganges water, for which people walk 200, 300 miles to take that much back for their ceremonies. We have, throughout August, our roads, our highways are blocked because the Kavadiyas, who are these pilgrims, who will come to collect Ganga water and take it back to their village. And there used to be 10,000 of them a few years ago. Now there are 10 million who do this pilgrimage. So for water for which that much, for carrying that much water, people will walk 200 miles. For that same water now, whole new projects are being laid. Now, because of Tehri, because of Ganga, because Suez was involved, I started to follow this up. And bit by bit, put the pieces together. Originally, I thought the $2 billion plant that they were building, At least that investment might be private. So we did the rest of the calculation on how much public investment went into making this project happen. The public investment included 100 billion rupees already invested in the Tehri Dam, as a result of which the government now says we put all our water budget into this dam, therefore we can't give you any water supply in the villages. And the village supply is being stopped. Because not only is water fixed, you know, if you put it here, you can't have it there. Budgets are fixed. If you put it all into one large dam, villages can't run. And since I go back to this area again and again and again, one of the public hearings we organized, the women told me about more than 100 suicides of women. Because the distance to collect water has gone so tough now. Because local water schemes are all being shut down. In addition to the 100 billion that's gone into the dam construction, 1.2 billion of other assets, the canals, the pipes, etc., are built by the public. And every year farmers will lose $2 billion of crops because the water that is today irrigating their fields will now be diverted to Delhi to be turned into sewage water. Can you imagine Ganga water becoming sewage water to be then dumped into the Yamuna to add to the sewage in the Yamuna? Well, it turns out that even that $2 billion is not a Suez investment. It turns out that 4 or 5 years ago, the World Bank came in with a $2.5 billion loan to say, reform, you know, the word is reform, and so who could be against reform? You know, you all turn into sinners and then you all have to reform. So $2.5 billion loan. No, it wasn't billion, it was 2.5 million. It was just a pathetic million. And they said, we're going to have a consultancy and now you're going to have to reform your water supply. Well, 1.9 immediately went to Pricewaterhouse. Yeah. Can you imagine auditing firms who've been found fudging with their audits, dealing with our water? If you can't trust them with accounts, how could you trust them with water? But 1.9 goes to them straight as a fee, and the remaining goes to them to spend on air-conditioned offices and air-conditioned cars and computers and laptops. And of course, the local public utility does all the work, because where does a Pricewaterhouse consultant know how much water there is? Where does it come from? How is it supplied? Well, as a result of that consultancy, the privatization of Delhi's water and sewage was imposed. And a new second loan was supposed to come. No loan came. The World Bank told us how much we should spend, but never gave the money with which this was supposed to be a conditionality. So to build the plant of $2 billion, it's the public utility that has spent twice the money that would be needed to build a utility of that size under public control. Just because there's that much more profits to be created. And then the consumers are expected to pay 10 times more in terms of water rates. And the justification for increase in water rates, and across the world, the figures are 100 to 300% increase the moment corporations enter a water delivery system. The argument is always two phrases. You must have full cost recovery, and you must remove subsidies. Now, in terms of full cost recovery, Suez is supposed to have full cost recovery, but the investment has been made by the public. So on 9th of August, we had a full cost recovery campaign for Suez. You know, we had people from Tehri, from Haridwar, the farmers, the Delhi citizens, all together. We went to the Suez plant and had a little postcard and said, this is how much the public has invested. We want full cost recovery. And in terms of subsidies, it's always made to look like the public investing its own resources in its own public goods and services is a subsidy. Yeah? But when those public investments divert to supplying profits, then they are no more subsidies. I'll give you just two examples. In this same plant, the water will be provided free of cost under the contract to Suez. and there will be a guarantee of supply. So in the years there's little rain, or in the years the lean season is bad, in the peak of the lean season, 635 million liters will still go to the Suez plant, no matter how much backstream water is not available. Now, the dam itself has already started to have impacts because the impoundment has started. For the first year on the Haridwar, you know, Haridwar is one of our most important pilgrim centers. For the first year on the ghats of Haridwar, there was no water. And because now we are working with people all along the Ganges Basin, the people of Banaras came to our public hearing and said, in Banaras, for the first time, where you had to go across the river in a boat, this year you could walk across the river. Because if you're starting to dam up the water, the flow downstream will stop. And if you're going to direct it to the city, the agriculture availability will go down. So there's that subsidy. That's a huge subsidy. And that's a subsidy created not just in terms of destruction of agriculture, denying the mountain women of their right to water. It's a subsidy in terms of literally destroying the spiritual, cultural, ecological lifeline of the largest population density of the world. If you look at the Ganges Basin, that's where most people in the world live, in terms of one place on earth. There is no other area which has such high density. Similar things happen in agriculture, you know, in food. Our entire food system has been dismantled, again in the name of stopping subsidies. The subsidy for food, to make sure everyone in India got affordable food under a universal public distribution system, it was just 20 billion rupees. But the World Bank said that was too much money. So now we are spending 220 billion rupees to starve the people. 20,000 starvation deaths have happened. Food prices have gone up fourfold in a decade. The poor can't afford to buy. But the same food, when it starts to stock up, because if you're not buying, the stocks grow, 65 million tons of stock, then the same World Bank says, you're wasting money storing it, now you export. So Cargill gets Indian wheat and rice at half the price that Indian people are paying. But when the subsidy goes to Cargill, it's not a subsidy, it's an export incentive. When it goes to the poor, it's a subsidy. And I think we really need to revisit some of these basic terms. The $200 billion new farm bill of the United States is again a similar support system to global corporations, even while small family farms get destroyed, even while no decent food is available to a large percent of population here. Well, the new thing that is starting to happen, and I thought it was first happening only in India, till an article in The New Scientist showed that this is a phenomena that's global, and therefore it's globally driven. And it's basically an idea that nature does not know how to make water flow. Takes it in the wrong directions. Yeah. So all of India's rivers, most of India's rivers flow east-west. One or two, like Narmada, the Indus system, flow west to east. Now, the west-east flow is supposed to be wrong. Now, supposed to make our rivers flow north-south. Now, while we are saying nature went wrong in not flowing rivers north to south, China is saying nature went wrong because rivers should be flowing south to north. And there is this amazing project floated suddenly December last year, simultaneously around the world, in the Amazon, in China, in India. And it's called river, they call it river linking. Linking. But it is really river diversion. And I'll tell you why they call it river linking. Because I think, again, it was Vinona yesterday talking about this 30 years of freeze of the mind and body. So they're living sort of a 10-year-old technological paradigm of connectivity. Yeah? The things should be connected. Connectivity was the mantra of the 90s. If you went to any conference anyway, it could be in economics, it could be on science, it could be on technology, it was always connectivity. And if you were not connected, something was wrong. Well, connectivity started as an information technology idea, that, you know, we should all be connected. But it moved into energy, and you had the blackout, and you showed what connectivity can do in that. But now they're using the same language for water, for rivers, saying rivers should be connected. I had an engineer of government debate with me to say, how can you be against the idea that if this river has too little water, we should take it from river B to A, and when A has too much, we should take it from A to B? And I said, because of gravity. You know, you but, you know, in a water paradigm in which it is assumed that gravity doesn't matter, as the literature in this field has started to say, under commodification, water starts to travel opposite of gravity. It starts to flow uphill to money. But once you've got that idea that water is not about gravity flow, it's about financial flow, then you can make it go this way and you can make it go that way because it's all in your head. But these are real. I mean, the guys who are seriously thinking this, so seriously that we had a Supreme Court. Well, we first had our new president who said all the rivers must be linked in India. And I don't know if many of you know our president's nickname in India is Missile Man. He's very proud of it because he's a nuclear missile expert. Well, and he thinks grand. And the other day, because we're having, this is the hottest debate in India of linking India's rivers, our prime minister went up to the Red Fort where we get our annual Independence Day speech. And he said, this is the most important project for India. And soon after that, the president says, small is criminal. Small is criminal. Big projects like river linking, $200 billion is what they're talking about. Everyone knows that's going to be five times more by the time they really get it going. But these river links can only be made if you make more dams. And it was recognized that dams are totally non-sustainable. But by talking about connectivity of water, in a way, dams are getting a new respect. We've just finished, the moment the Prime Minister announced they were going to link the Cane and the Bethwa, and the Cane is such a beautiful river. I've grown up, my father was posted along it, and the stones in the Cane, they're not fossils, but they for some reason have an imprint of plants. So every stone's translucent, transparent stones. And in it will be imprints of trees and plants. Most beautiful river. Till today, pristine. Absolutely clean. Flows through a national park. This river diversion they're talking about will have a dam in the heart of a national park. And the people who are being displaced are being told the reason is to move you. They don't tell them it's to take the water somewhere else. They say, we have to remove you because you're becoming a threat to the wildlife. If this dam and this river link, 250 miles of making canals go across a river basin, and for any of you who have a feel for water, you know, taking canals across a river basin is a ready-made recipe for waterlogging and floods. Because you start stopping the water where it wants to drain out. And once you stock it too much, you're going to get more malarial epidemics, you're going to get more destruction of agriculture. And instead of increasing agriculture zones, you're going to actually ruin the areas with agriculture. The river Cane is a small river. There's another river, Bethwa, which is a big river. So they're taking water from a small river to a big river. Why? Because the big river has had dams in the past. And those were all non-sustainable. So today, four large projects on that river are dead. And the river diversion is largely a way of killing a living river to reactivate dead rivers for another 5 to 10 years. And that's why we have this very, very big movement against the so-called linking of rivers. We call it river diversion. And we call it delinking of rivers from people and culture. Because culture evolves along river basins. Every city, every town in Hindustani, the very word for a place where people live, a settlement, is abadi. Ab is water. Abadi is water-derived places. Every pilgrim center in India is up in the mountain at the source of a river. Badrinath, Kedarnath, Gangotri, Yamunotri. Whoever worked the system out was brilliant, because basically through spirituality, they turned watersheds and catchments into conservation zones. And you can, you know, you travel the Himalaya, which is today very, very degraded in large parts, because a British man called, Wilson got the entire contract for the Ganges catchment, timber, for 50 rupees, $1 today. So he chop. It's absolutely, but suddenly in the middle of no vegetation, you'll see a lush forest. And inside that lush forest might be a temple just that high. Will be a goddess. And the reason people haven't cut those trees is because it's linked to sacred values. One of the other arguments constantly used for commodification and privatization of water is, oh, you know, the water has been wasted because we didn't give it value. And therefore, we must put a price. Therefore, you must put a price on it. But price in the market is actually a devaluation of water. Because water's value, ecologically, culturally, spiritually, is much higher than any market could ever give. And the only places where water gets conserved is where those other values exist. You can put water in the market and put a price, but there's enough money in that fictitious market of $3 trillion of money moving around the world to be able to destroy the last drop of every groundwater, every river, every lake, every tank in the world. In India, our movement to protect water and people's rights to water, and we don't separate the two issues, we work the two in together. We call it Jal Swaraj, very inspired by Gandhi's notion of Swaraj, of self-governance. For us, self-governance is the river governing itself, flowing in the direction it wanted to flow. If the Ganga wanted to go to the Sundarbans and into the Bay of Bengal, that's where it should go. The Ganga should not be taken down to the Mahanadi, Godavari, Krishna, Kaveri. No. It needs its own sovereignty. But the people along these rivers need their sovereignties and their democracy. What we are doing is, after we get some of the basic studies done, we start organizing public hearings. First, very localized public hearings, then basin-level public hearing, to work out exactly how do we want to govern our water and ourselves. At the end of a series of river hearings, we're going to call the government to say, here are our proposals. And we expect you to follow them. And if you don't, we will have to do what Gandhi did, which is a satyagraha. We're already preparing the people in these key river links where the canals will take off and the new dams will be built. We're already bringing them the information so that they're ready with the direct action to say, we won't move. Sorry. You can't kill these rivers. You can't kill this land. But there's just quickly two other issues I want to touch on before wrapping up. We've talked a lot about bottled water. And most people don't realize the cost that bottled water has in the supply of it. In India, there is currently, I think, the biggest water movement outside the Ganges, fighting the Ganges privatization. The biggest water movement is a group of tribal women in Kerala, which is water-rich Kerala, where Coke put up a plant, started to extract 1 million liters a day of groundwater, 1,000 feet deep tube wells, and within a year had transformed an ecosystem where you could get water at 10 feet into an ecosystem where no lake, no well, no stream had water left. So the women started a protest and said they must stop. When I go back on 20th and 21st, I will be with the women. Because the local community has ordered this plant must shut. And in a way, much of this water privatization is undermining our existing constitutional system of local governance. Rights we had to be able to make a decision locally, just because the Cokes can function at the level of bribing a Delhi government or a Trivandrum government. They constantly subvert and undermine the democratic rights of people. So Cork is going definitely one more of the actors in this, and we hope some of you will be able to travel to India. We have the World Social Forum in India in January. Before that, we are going to organize the Water Forum. Tony and Maud and all of us will be finalizing some more of the detail. But our organization, the Research Foundation, will be organizing a few tours in these critical areas, the Ganga, the Plachimada plant of Coca-Cola. For those of you who might want to offer solidarity, become part of a larger movement. And I think the reason is not just that water is so important to our biological survival. I think it's so important for peace in our times. And you know, some of the worst violence in my region, in the subcontinent of India, has been religious strife created, literally from the 30s onwards, when the British wanted to stay in power. And then Hindu-Muslim crises were committed. We had the partition, Pakistan was formed. And we are once again getting a return, bombings every day, massacres of 2,000 Gujaratis, Mumbai blast just last week. Add all this up. It's in the name of Hindu versus Muslim. But the word Hindu is derived from the river Sindhu, which is in the Arabic version called Indus, but in the Sanskrit version called Sindhu. In a way, there is no religion called Hindu. There is a region where the Indus flows. And once you recognize that this is a regional identity, an identity of place, Hindus are not the opposite of Muslims. The Muslims are part of the land named after a great river, Sindhu. And I think very much in that light, whether it's the Iraq war, whether it's Afghanistan, I think if we could just start going back to our identities of place, if we could start going back to the rivers that shaped us, we'll be able to take new steps in the creation of peace and sustainability. Thank you.
Thank you, Vandana, for bringing this issue of water from your Indian experience, but putting in the context of the whole world situation. So thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. Now, we have a few minutes for questions, so I'll take about 3 or 4 questions. So please hear first.
Thank you, Vandana. That was a wonderful presentation again. I'm Sarah Van Gelder from Yes Magazine, and the question I have is about where you think the most powerful political counter to this privatization can come from. Robert Kennedy spoke on the first day of the conference about how important it is to have federal laws, because he said that it's easier for the corporations to subvert local democracies than it is for them to subvert the federal laws. I'm hearing you say that it's really important that the power be brought back to the local communities at the watershed level to make these decisions. And then there's also this global movement. And I'm just wondering if you can help us sort out where is the most powerful countervailing force coming from in order to counter this privatization?
Thank you.
You know, I'm a very deep believer in diversity and have very serious allergies to monocultures of any kind. Including for political action. I don't think there's any one magic level. I think we need robustness at every level. We need strong communities with strong articulation and practice of democracy. We need those strong communities and local democracy instructing federal levels about the obligations for that federal level. And we need that process go all the way into the global level to say certain things are not on. For example, water being turned into an aspect of free trade commodities in the General Agreement on Trade and Services is not on. And in any living system, and if democracy has to be real, it has to be living. In any living system, there is circulation. and the circulation from the global to the national to the local, and the circulation from the local to the national to the global. And I think one reason we haven't been as effective as we could have been is because we look for that perfect level. Then we all go like herds to the global level. So it didn't work. Then we all go to the local level. And then we very often, I mean, we had this conversation last night, Satish and I, and then we say, okay, we must duplicate, yeah? So-and-so did it right, let me do it. No, but the contexts are different, what's going to work more naturally as a first step. All steps are necessary everywhere, but as a first step, different things will be more easy in different contexts. And that first step, we end up usually taking the duplication mode, mimicking mode, rather than the multiplication mode, saying, what is it that will create large synergy, large support, and huge multiplier action? So I would say there is no one single place. Every place is the right place. Every level is the right level.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Briefly, please.
I'm Annette Smith. I'm from Vermont. I'm dealing with a multinational corporation doing limestone mining. I'm trying to stop a mine. The multinational corporation came in last year and did a pump test. And this is a little more specific in terms of water, but they pumped 3 or 4 million gallons of water out of our valley without permits. And a lot of us lost our water. And now my ponds are dry. I'm trying to understand in the karst system, what is it in drilling new wells that can open up new fractures and change the water patterns? Could it be just the volume of water they pumped out? In other words, I'm interested in more of the science of what goes on underground in a karst system.
It'll be both. It will be both. There will be creation of new fissures. But because these are interconnected storage systems, the sucking out in one place will affect the storage in another place.
Is there anything that can be done? I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to respond to this.
Get them out.
Well, they're not doing anything. I'm working on that. But some people have said you can fill the wells they drilled and close up the systems, or is what's changed forever?
Well, I definitely think what has changed forever and will have changed in ways far more complex than any engineering intervention is going to be able to address.
So in my community where lots of us lost our water and things seem to have changed, nobody seems to think that anything that happened there made any difference. How do I convince my community to not let them do more? This is one of the most biodiverse valleys in the state. I feel that they've already caused irreparable harm, but, you know, it's jobs.
Well, you know, in a way, all of water destruction and all of water commodification is based on wiping out water connections and not letting us know why we experience the scarcity or whatever we do. The new language that's being created in privatization is water is a manufacture. It's only when it comes through cement canals and dams and pipes, then, and goes through treatment plants, then it's water. The other is raw material. So what was done to nature as a whole is now being particularly done to water. And, you know, we had patents on life with the definition that life is a manufacture. And now we are being told water commodification is necessary because water is a manufacture. And I think our responsibility as human beings in the tooth. I think this is so strange that so late in our evolution, we are having to turn to such basics, like how do we manage water? How do we create knowledge once again of how our water is connected? And I'm sure all of you are involved in one way or the other. But if you need particular stuff on the limestone issue, I have a book called The Ecology and Politics of Survival of it. It's a SAGE. It's an academic publication. It's got everything on the caste landscape. So maybe you can tell.
Thank you very much, Vandana. Thank you again.
You were listening to Vandana Shiva speaking on September 6th at the Water of Life Conference in Rhinebeck, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our next speaker is John Todd, who also spoke at the Water of Life conference.
I'm a water doctor, and I guess I've almost always been a water doctor. When I was a small child, I lived directly on the shore of Lake Ontario at its western end. I knew the marshes and the streams, the fishes, the woods that followed the ravines up to the limestone headlands that had caves, oak hickory forests, and scattered between them small farms. Between the ages of about 8 years of age and 12 years of age, my world was to a large degree destroyed. The marshes that I knew became a golf course. The hilllands and the fields became subdivisions. And the small streams with their sucker populations spawning in the spring disappeared. And up under the headlands, under the cliffs, which were filled with what people called Indian caves, in the end became the head offices for a number of large corporations. And I was literally, as a young boy, psychologically torn apart. And my parents, bless them, gave me the writings of a man, Louis Bromfield, and he talked about the healing of a valley in Ohio that had been destroyed, the bringing back to life the streams, the springs and the woods, using ancient, well-proven techniques he'd learned in France, living half a lifetime in France, combined with some of the modern teachings of ecology. And for me, at 13 years of age, there was a sequence of 5 books, I realized that it is possible to heal what has been destroyed, and that I set myself out on a life of trying to find the tools of healing. And very early on, I discovered that perhaps the only teacher we really have is this 3.5 billion year or so experiment called life. Somehow, through these vast reaches of time, diverse nature has solved problems of energy, of resources, of materials, of light, of flow, of storms, that somehow they can do things and they do it totally natural. And if only we could somehow read the language of nature and decode the language of nature, that we would begin to see the world anew. And we would begin to do, say, what a coral reef does. A coral reef is a very impossible thing if you think about it. It's a vast, diverse biome of life in a sea almost devoid of nutrients. How is it that you could have that diversity, that beauty? It's also a biome that lives in a sea of violence. Think of the storms and the waves and the hurricanes. And if you look very carefully in there, you see a world where the very architecture of the coral itself is designed to dissipate energy. And the very exchanges between the plants, animals, and microbial life are designed to dance nutrients when nutrients are scarce, much like the desert you spoke about earlier. And you begin to realize that whether it's the reef or the forest or the meadow or the prairie or the pond or the lake, that there is great, great wisdom. And so the real journey for me and for many others has been to try and unlock that wisdom, both ancient and new. New, I mean, having come through some of the modern ecological tools. And so I'd like to show you